This program is brought to you by Resonance FM. If you like what you hear, please support our work by making a donation at resonancefm.com/donate.
Good afternoon, you're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. This week's Wavelength follows on from the previous Wavelengths that focused on cassette tape as a medium. On the 31st of January 2020, I was joined by Sam Robinson, also known as Kalou, that's K-A-L-O-U, who produces tapes of upbeat songcraft composed with the medium of cassette firmly in mind. Dan Wilson, who has a cameo role on the Kalou album The Sculpture Garden, also joins the discussion. As Kalou, Sam Robinson works with a postmodern potpourri of techniques producing an eclectic range of musical moods, plunderphonic lucky dips, the catharsis stroke neurosis inherent in pop, and a critique of considering songwriters and artists too reverently. The programme features Kalou's album The Sculpture Garden, which is still available at www.kalou.co.uk.
Sie hören die Sendung Wellenlänge. Vous écoutez la transmission longueur d'onde. Udite la trasmissione lunghezza d'onde. You are hearing the transmission called wavelength.
Faded out the usual bonging of the Syston clock. I thought I'd fade in the international version of the Wavelength introduction, featuring Hugh de la Cruz and Maurice Seddon. And then we went straight into a track from The Sculpture Garden by Kalou, otherwise known as Samuel Shelton Robinson, who is this week's guest, along with sound artist Dan Wilson, The two of them will probably force me into the back seat with their conversations and information.
Possibly.
It's called The Sculpture Garden. That was the first track. And this is a new release on cassette, I think.
It is, yeah. I try and put out each album I've made in the last 10 years. I've tried to release a kind of cassette version of that. I just think there's something quite special and about having kind of a physical, tangible version that I can kind of make myself and design and give to people as a kind of...
Does this impede distribution?
I think my distribution is seriously limited in the sense that, like, the demand for the music is limited. So in terms of the physical amount I need to make, it's a small quantity.
Right. So what would be the edition size of such a piece?
Probably about 50, I think, for this one. And okay. A lot would be distributed to friends and family. Though right. Anyone that likes the music
is this a strategy to remain underground or to deliberately kind of circumvent the internet or
That's
whatever?
That's what I think. Because I think you've got a song writing sensibility that's has potentially very wide appeal, and you're almost following the outsider model. I know you're a fan of Daniel Johnston, and there's a possibly your 50 is a bit low. Maybe you should do 100 editions.
I think if I sensed the demand was there, I would definitely increase the edition, but I just know from previous experience that it's not there. Though if that demand does develop, I'm happy to produce more. I would love for people to listen to and enjoy my music, and the more the merrier. Like, I have no kind of like sense of wanting to be kind of some niche.
Well, then why issue it on cassette and not say presumably it is already
it's digitally available as well, so right. Anyone can download it and stream it on any of the kind of classic platforms. I just like kind of, in a way, a lot of it's like a thank you to people that have been a great support to me, whether through the production of the album or just kind of an emotional support, a friend. Right. I want to have something tangible that I can give back and say, here's a piece of myself. Here's
so the cassette becomes like a limited edition sort of art multiple?
It's like a thank you card in a way. Oh. And like a kind of like sonic diary that I can then give to people and say, here's how I felt. I really appreciate your support.
Right.
So it's very personal. Project in a way.
Definitely. Yeah. Definitely.
But has this, well, I'm calling it cassette culture. You can shout me down if you like, both of you. Is that reasonable?
Yeah.
There is a sort of cassette culture, isn't there, which hasn't that now, recent of late, as far as I know, become, I mean, I think I heard that Robbie Williams has issued something on cassette.
I know a lot of big artists have been doing, like Mark Ronson, they release these kind of extremely like rare, like, expensive limited edition cassettes, but for me, like, my kind of interest in cassettes dates back to when I was a kid buying cassettes, you know. That's right. What music was commonly on. I couldn't afford the CDs and the tape were cheaper.
Right.
And then getting started making music, I had a 4-track tape recorder, and that's how I made the original
right.
music that I
produced.
But
perhaps it's not quite as underground as it was.
Something's missing, I think, in this new wave of tape love of tapes. It's there's a certain section of people that are excluded from the whole tape revival, and I've found this. I do tape dropping, as has been described before on the show, and I know that you do as well. You've been dropping Kalu cassettes in places in Britain and America.
It goes back to what you were saying about demand. Like, I found for Scrapbook, which I released in 2014-15, I made maybe 50 to 100 copies. And I gave away a lot, sent to some to reviewers, which was gratefully got reviewed, but then kind of had an excess of them, was about to move back to the UK, and I needed to do something with them because I didn't want to bring them back. So I distributed them at local laundromats, which are kind of public laundry
right.
facilities. So hopefully someone picked them up and enjoyed them.
So you just leave them in random automats?
I did,
laundromats.
Laundromats.
Yes. Laundromats.
And when was this? What year would that be?
That would have been probably 2016-17.
Oh, that's still. I think the tape thing, it became less effective to drop cassettes around 2008 or 2009, because it was no longer a staple of people's homes to have a cassette.
Oh yes,
deck
there is
there,
that
generally.
Isn't there?
And although, as you say, there's still a certain clique or a certain niche of people that still have cassette players and. things or restored cassette players, but that's a very knowing...
Dan, weren't you... I think you were probably a bit of a pioneer of this cassette dropping.
I was doing it in the 1990s to get back at bullies at school. What I would do is
How does that work? How are you getting back at bullies by dropping a cassette?
Well, the music wouldn't be as listenable as Sam's music, which is like an enjoyable listen. Some nice pieces of songcraft and quite intriguing sound diaries as well. They're kind of collages as well of Sam's thing, but my stuff was more... That's not a good... with distortion.
So your idea was a bully would pick this up, a bully that... You would leave it somewhere where a bully that you, someone that bullied you, might frequent. They might pick it up.
It would be in their desk drawer, in their lockers, or in their shoes. Even at PE, you could just leave it in a shoe. usually the pitch would be lower to give the impression it came from someone much older, which was always a creepy. And you'd raid the cabinets of teachers' cabinets where they used to keep the spoken exams on cassette, and I'd find their own voice reading French oral examinations, and then just put those into the cassette as well.
Right.
Anyway, back to you.
Yes.
I think of the kind of cassette revival as more of like a DIY. In the States, I recognized it as like touring bands wanted to release something kind of CDs. No one had CD players. They were all streaming. So they produced like short runs of cassettes. So this kind of the way kind of Mark Ronson or Robbie Williams, that's a different thing from like what I'm attracted to. Okay.
So actually,
but it's also the sonic texture of a tape, the warmth that you get. It's like the vinyl thing. But actually, I think I maybe prefer the tape sound.
The tape sound. That's interesting. With the hiss and the...
Vinyl's like really fetishized. I think like tape, but there's something.
So are people now buying new cassette players?
Well, I've found a lot. They're very cheaply made. They're made like Tic Tac boxes now. If you buy a brand new cassette player, you take it apart and it's not user serviceable. There's a blob inside, and a blob is like a cheaply made amplifier chip that's not when it goes wrong, it'll be impossible to repair. They're not very well made. The plastic is brittle.
But are they now remanufacturing them for this market?
Yeah, and they're not very well made either. I'd recommend to seek out an original. I was going to ask you, do you think this cassette revival is something to do with the ease at which vintage tape technology can just be found in bins, discarded in thrift stores? I know that an overseas friend, Joey Pizza Slice, who pioneered the eraserless head recording mechanism, he identified he would take apart tape machines to remove the erase head to do overdubs, and he'd record under the Son of Salami moniker. But he found that they were just easy to find. At some point around 2011, 2012, they were everywhere.
In the States, there's definitely a lot of thrift stores, they call them, where you can get vintage hi-fi gear, like an old tape deck that it was actually probably quite good quality, like you're talking about, that it would be user replaceable. That's less available here. I've got a confession to make that I actually don't listen to that many cassettes my own, so it might invalidate everything I've spoken about prior to. To Dan's point, I actually think potentially a lot
of the
people.
You're a non-believer.
I'm a believer.
It's not convenient.
It's just not convenient at the moment in my current setup. But I think actually potentially a lot of the people buying these high-end Robbie Williams cassettes are not listening to them, and people buy things as a collector's item and the kind of cachet behind that, I think.
I've got a spare Walkman I can give you if you...
I have a beautiful, beautiful Sony Walkman. Lovely.
Okay. What about the Walkman that we've got here today? Is this any good?
This is a wonderful model. This Williams got the Sony Professional or something like W6C. So I'm I definitely have a lot of interest in it. I remember making a guide to how to make your Walkman Bluetooth compatible, and I've got a lot of interest in it.
Is there something about cassette or the cassette player that you can only do with a cassette player that makes it sort of intrinsic to that medium? That you cannot be...
For me, the accessibility to recording when I was younger was like a real attraction to cassettes. Like now everyone's got a computer or you can record a song on your smartphone. Then, even before the four track, just having a tape recorder where you could record, play a song...
Instantly.
Yeah. And hearing it back is such a thrill. So I think in my mind, that still resonates with
me. There is one thing as well that I think is unique to tapes. it could be done digitally, but it's where you've got a multi-track tape recorder. And I know you used to use a Yamaha MT-120, which is what I used as well, 4-track, and you could change the speed. So if you wanted to do backing vocals, you could just slow the entire song down and do
on
something
on one track.
Yeah, and right. Tape. Uh-huh. And although everything would be going slower, you could record something over it. It doesn't have to be vocals. It could be something like a guitar, and it would give the impression that you're better at playing the guitar than you really are, because when you brought the pitch back to normal again, you'd hear the guitar brought up to speed, and so you could actually play things a lot quietly at lower pitches, record them at that speed.
But what most people would think the drawback of tape is, if you want to find a track, for example, you have to sort of whiz through and try and find it, because there's no way of knowing where the beginning of the track is or where the end of the track is.
There are features on some cassette players where it kind of can skip, it can isolate.
Oh, really?
Find out where the blank space is.
You can put it on fast wind and it suddenly stops at that point.
The cassette Walkman I have does that feature.
But even so, that is a sort of, once the order of the tracks has been established, they're fixed in that order, aren't they? There's no random shuffler.
And there's something quite nice about that sense of being, you listen to an album as a whole piece, as opposed to kind of skipping around, because you have that ease of doing
it. Mixed tapes?
Loved them. But I haven't made one for a long time.
Okay.
So I can imagine a Kaloo track on someone's mixtape.
Well, there's a guy that, I think, I don't know a guy, there's a person online that produces these bedroom cassette mixes, compilations, that anyone could submit something to. They just have to have made something within kind of that time period, so 1980 to 1989, or have made it kind of with the equipment that would be around and kind of claim it to them. Yeah. And there's a clue track on a few of those mixes. Oh.
Yeah. I mean, we all have cassettes in common in a way, because even I did the 7 tapes, of course.
Which we just heard.
At the beginning.
Which I absolutely loved.
Yeah. Which I still have about 100 cassettes, which I haven't even listened to yet, because there were so many. There was this sort of big backlog of tapes that Maurice Seddon left. He recorded all of his telephone conversations.
So might there be a volume 2 then of that record?
Well, I was just going to say that when I actually put it to Clive Graham of Paradigm Discs, who issued the 7 tapes, volume 1, I sort of said, well, perhaps we should issue it on cassette, you know, to be more true to the original. And he sort of said, well, no, that's ridiculous, because it would just never sell. Nobody would buy it, and it wouldn't get distribution. But as it happens, the record hasn't sold too well either. We've still got several hundred of those.
I've got I've got the record, but can't play it because I don't have a record player. But have got two or three tape players.
So you haven't got the vinyl player, okay? Oh, right. But anyway, volume 2, might be a volume 2.
There's an interesting crossover here, because one of the paradoxes at the heart of Kaloo is you've got one track, which I think sums up a concept or one of the themes of the album, which is reverence is dead, and the idea that hype and the artist being like this noble figurehead that you buy his or her wares, usually him though, that's the reverence is dead, is like harking back to this more top-down quite a dusty old time period in the history of 20th century culture, and with this hierarchy being demolished dismantled, yeah, that's it, it's more difficult to attain. The paradox is that, hang on, let me explain this. It's a difficult paradox. The paradox is that you're saying reference is dead, but at the same time nobody's listening. Or we've tried to seize the means of distribution. We've seized the means of production, but we've not seized the means of distribution yet.
I think for me, the track Reverence is Dead, which I hope we'll get to hear a bit later, is definitely aside from kind of my ambition as a musician wanting to get my music heard. It's definitely more speaking to a sense of not wanting to revere people in positions of power just because they're in that position of power, as you have no sense of necessarily how they got to that position, or whether it was kind of through like merit and everyone deserves respect and you kind of get what you give type attitude. When you hear it, you'll hear kind of reverence is in the song, kind of it's an instrumental, but reverence, you kind of get the sense is running wild, and then reverence kind of comes up against
which track obstacle. Is this
is the third track I'm here. So third on the album, yeah.
Should we play track two yet or not?
Yeah, let's
see. That's that way we'd get to track three. and that way we could even talk about that one. All right, so should we play track two?
Okay, this is
this called?
This is The Thin Line. This is actually a cover of a friend Rose Droll's song. Yes.
Relax. Feel heavy and feel very warm.
Was that track?
That was The Thin Line.
Okay.
So there's someone I knew in San Francisco, Rose Droll, incredible musician, and she had written this song that I kind of became transfixed with, and kind of I get kind of quite obsessive about something, so I'll listen to it over and over again. And I was living in Belgium for a month or so, and when I moved back to San Francisco, I told her how much I loved this track, and she was, I think, a bit taken aback by like how intensely I really loved it. And I said, "Can I cover it?" And she,
I tried to find the original, and she's taken it offline. The original.
I don't think she has. It resonates with her as much as it does with me, in a way. I don't think, because she's actually incredibly prolific and has written a gazillion songs since and before. So it's just I've kind of picked out.
Okay. Yeah, the obscure one.
This one song, and kind of really taken a liking to it.
But you were talking about sampling on this record?
This song in particular, this is like kind of, just in terms of like the way I produce, there's all sorts of kind of ingredients put into this. There's field recordings and sample of the, I won't say it for who, but a sample of a popular 80s band.
No, you can like, say, you don't have to. No one's
I don't
gonna,
want them to come and.
Even there's only 50 copies of there's only they're not going to.
There's a very very small little like drum sample from the special second album. If you can like pick that out. Mm-hmm.
Is that a problem then, Dan? You're saying, oh no, we shouldn't say that. Is that a problem these days?
No, it's fine. I don't think there's any problem with sampling. I don't know. I mean, when I get old, maybe if someone sampled me and I desperately needed royalties. But no, I think
I mean, I've covered
reverence is dead.
Yeah, it's less a reverence thing, more just a litigious thing.
I think. Yeah, litigiousness isn't dead.
Litigiousness is not dead. I think I've also covered TLC.
When Dan first mentioned you coming on the show and I listened to one of the tracks, I said to Dan that, I don't know if it was that track in particular, it reminded me slightly of Big Audio Dynamite. And are you both in agreement with that, or is that a bit, I'm a bit off the beam there?
Well, there are postmodern sampling bits of everything in there in the Big Audio Dynamite repertoire. So I think that's an accurate.
That was okay, was it?
That was definitely okay. It was okay. That's flattering. I think with my music, this is all over the place. So this album is nothing like 2014's Scrapbook, which is predominantly sample based
and experimental,
and a bit more experimental and mostly instrumental. This is kind of, I had feelings and things I wanted to express, so it came out more in kind of a more traditional kind of song style.
Well, it's quite uncharacteristic for William's show as well. It's quite a popular style, but I tend to view your most popular, there's an experimentalism in there somehow, somewhere. And I don't know if that owes anything to your sound art background.
Potentially. I think there was always an experimenter within me, and then I was kind of studied sound art and kind of got this. I think I felt free in that, like, I don't have a real sense of music theory, don't come from a kind of that kind of background. Everything's self-taught and kind of like off the cuff. And I feel like my time studying sound art kind of freed me and made that kind of validated that to a degree. But I've always kind of really been a sponge for like pop music and all sorts of music. So I think you absorb it all and then kind of like expel it into.
Yeah.
So when you were in your experimental phase, what kind of sound art?
I liked a lot of kind of, I was really, became really invested in kind of sampling and kind of really like John Oswald and Plunderphonics.
Ah, okay.
And kind of really ingrained myself in that world.
Right. And field recordings?
Field recordings I loved doing. I used to be really disciplined about doing field recording a lot and incorporating that into the music I made. And there's still elements of that in the Sculpture Garden, but less than there were potentially in previous stuff.
And are you hoping that maybe one of these would break through and become very popular?
I think
because they all have a kind of 3-minute, 4-minute sort of format now.
Yeah.
And as Dan was saying, it's kind of popular. Sounds sort of popular, no?
I think it sounds popular, but actually if you listen to it properly, it's a bit
claustrophobic
and kind of a bit like there's something a bit off about it, because I feel like and I think that kind of that represents how I feel. There's not kind of a real there's a poppy sheen, maybe, in terms of like harmonies. And
I remixed one of the tracks on your album. That's why I'm here. But I don't know if we're going to play it or not. But when I was listening to the a cappella, I could see that as you were singing, you were at the end of some of the lines, you trail off in a sense of almost futility, and I think that's where the claustrophobia is in there. There's a kind of yin yang of between the light and the dark, if that makes sense.
That's not necessarily unpopular, is it? I mean, that wouldn't make it unpopular.
Well, I suppose not. But to me, there was something philosophically ingrained when I heard those a cappellas, and I thought there's an interesting, like, almost.
But as your own career as Meadowhouse, you have also
embraced futility.
Albums. Well, I wasn't going to say that. No, I wasn't going to say you'd embraced futility. I was going to say you've released albums with, you know, 3-minute tracks, and they're quite sort of, you know, funky almost, but obviously. Are you both ambitious to break through into and
I've never told anyone, but I studied popular music at Hartford Regional College, a big mistake in the year 2000, and I don't know why. I think it's my parents pushed me into it because they thought I was going too experimental,
right?
And they wanted to plug
me. Wanted you to be a success.
Well, they wanted to. What's that David Cronenberg line from Videodrome? They wanted to plug me back into the mixing board of humanity by learning popular music.
Okay.
And it was a disaster. The tutors left, and they some of the equipment was stolen. And in the end, the drama department marked all our work. They just put a nominal pass on everyone, regardless of the effort. Anyway, I think that's why.
But were you trying to sabotage your own career as a popular musician?
No, it's just I've absorbed, like Sam, I've absorbed. I think that's why I'm drawn to Sam's stuff as well. It's like I've absorbed a lot, and I'm interested in the engineering behind it, the actual unusual stereo effects. And I mean, I'm actually an advocate for microtonal music, and if you could make a microtonal pop record, it could have some.
Okay. So there's no hidden agenda here.
Is definitely like a sense of I really like deep down, like I do other things for work, but there's a part of me that's still a teenager that really likes the idea of like getting paid to make music and people really enjoying that. When I was a teenager, I used to play in bands and you play live, and there is like natural adrenaline and joy from that. And then kind of as you get a bit older, it sort of seems a bit more of a hassle, and you recognize, oh, it's especially if you're the primary songwriter and you're kind of teaching people parts, and
there's a great book by.
But you play in a band of sorts. It's a different kind of group, but you must experience that kind of
oscillatorial binage.
Exactly, yes, that kind.
That's
of,
definitely not a popular band.
No,
I think maybe you could, even though the music isn't popular music, you maybe still get the same joy out of.
Exactly. Yeah,
the thrill of playing live.
There is, and also the pieces are all about 3 minutes in oscillatory binage as well. Actually, so it's almost like a ghost of popular music. We're still using the kind of timings, but all these found objects and electromagnetic force fields. There's a difference there. But there's a great book by an African-American classicist, The Appreciation of Musical Sounds, I think it's called, from the 70s. It's the first time I've ever seen written down the feeling you get when you listen to a piece of music, and it sends you off on a kind of fantasy, and you can. It reminded me of listening to things on Walkmans, and so I haven't got the quote with me, but it just reminded me of what you're describing, the vision, the kind of ideals that recorded music with melody and rhythm can possibly trigger.
Coincidentally, I was thinking of asking Dan recently whether he thought that there was a point would come when people realised his genius, kind of thing, and everything clicked. And
who, me?
Whether you and people? Because I think Dan actually his songwriting can write incredibly popular, poppy kind of songs with mass appeal, with great hooks.
Yeah.
It's really about choice. It's about, I feel like even in my songwriting, and I'm not kind of tooting my own horn, that if you set yourself a goal of I want to write a 2.5-3 minute pop song with a mass appeal kind of thing, and you, it wasn't imbued with feelings that you necessarily had, but just with this aim, that it's possible. And I think Dan could do it too. It's just it's about choosing what you want to do with your creativity and with your time. And I think for me, I get more value out of kind of exercising feelings and putting them into music
catharsis
than I do out of trying to produce something that's going to have like mass appeal, that's going to you know, I'll be able to make a living out of.
Okay.
Well, you're very complimentary on my songwriting.
Justifiably so.
Oh, thanks, Sam. I'm doing it from panic. I looked at the versatility. You know, there's a panic. You have to be versatile in these times. You have to jump between like a 1930s jazz standard to a...
You have to be optimistic as
Cantonese
well.
Opera and optimistic. Yeah. I think you're also very versatile. It's almost like the genres have been completely demolished in the last 20 years or so, and maybe digital technology is a lot to answer for in that way. And you've very much in that postmodern style of everything's relative, and there's sampling in there, and there's all sorts of styles going on.
It sounds cliche to say kind of like you're not really interested in genres. Actually, when I think about it, we're speaking about kind of late 90s stuff where the style was like throw everything in, which actually I think it doesn't end up generally sounding very good. I think there was a deliberate attempt by some bands, Brand 3000 is Beck. One we could think of, to throw everything into the mix, and actually it's not cohesive, and there's not a real sense of like what this is about. So I don't go in making music with the intention of I want to throw in all these elements. The songs come out with whatever kind of tools or way kind of best express that feeling or sentiment.
Can I jump in? Speaking of postmodernism, as you were, Dan, you've recently put something up on YouTube, which is yes, which is a version of Cars, where you discovered the Mary A. Gunn, who apparently released the first version of Cars.
As popularised by Gary Newman.
And as a when trying to explain that to me, you pointed me in the direction of I Don't Want to Go to Rehab by Noel Coward.
Yes.
And I'm wondering what the philosophy is behind this stuff, because it's creating.
Well, let me
it's
describe
almost
it.
Like fake news, isn't it?
Let me describe it to Sam. I don't know if there's a guy who did a 1930s, he would do 1930s remakes of modern songs. Rehab by Amy Winehouse was one of them. Firestarter by Prodigy was another one. And his name was Wisby. But he deleted them all. And that upload I showed you was actually a re-upload. He's a friend of Johnny Trunk's, but he does it very convincingly. He does a Noel Coward impression. He produces he's got the vinyl crackle sound. He's got the saturation of like an old 78 record. And it sounds like Rehab by Amy Winehouse, but sung by Noel Coward. And obviously Rehab didn't exist in the 1930s. So Rehab is a place in Marrakesh. And there's a whole middle eight where it goes
on. But it gives the impression that the song actually dates back to the 30s with a different meaning.
Yes.
But isn't there a sense that you're contributing to like sort of some
false
fake news
history.
Thing?
No,
something that people will believe to be true.
Only because, this is why fake news, you have to be aware what's real and what's not. The Wisby, I think that's his name, prefaced his videos with a very clear, this is, you know, if people were bothered to read the YouTube descriptions, they'll see this isn't real. I did the same, as you said, with the Gary Newman track, which I said was by Mary A. Gunn,
which is an anagram of
Gary Newman, recorded in 1968 using analog technology. And some people have been fooled by it. Someone offered me £150 for the record, and I thought of taking it, actually, and just sending them. No, I won't do that.
Okay. So you'd have to literally create a false record then. You have to fake a vinyl single.
Yeah, it's not worth it for £150. Anyway,
good project. Quick way to make money.
You could become an art forger. Okay, so we've got off at a bit of a tangent there. We should get back to Kalu, which is Samuel Shelton Robinson.
But it's about versatility, and yes. Kalu actually is has a versatility as well. I think that's a modern thing. That's the digital age. It's almost begs for these alternative histories. The humanity yearns for to know what happened in an alternate timeline. And I think these fake remakes of popular songs are perhaps
it sort of leads into sampling a bit, doesn't it? It's a bit sort
of
like,
but I think it's a manifestation of this.
What do you think, Sam?
What's the intention, do you think, of this Mary A. Gunn? Is it to to fool people.
That's a good point.
Well, actually, funny enough, the track, the Mary Gun track, which I did, was actually...
Well, that's you.
Yeah, yeah, it's me, yeah.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah. That wasn't clear to me.
No,
okay.
Right. No, he's created a new... without vocals...
Yeah, no, I listened to it. I just didn't recognise it. I didn't know that was you.
Well, funnily enough, that we first met when I first met Sam. It was at the bumper cars installation. I can't remember.
Oh, yes, across the way.
Which you went to as well, very briefly.
Yeah.
At the old fire station.
Right.
I can't remember who. It was a Merge Festival event. And that's when I first met you. And the piece was actually composed for the bumper cars event.
Oh.
And I just ran it through a kind of vinyl simulator to see what it sounded like as if it was a vinyl. I thought, oh, I'll put it on YouTube. Right. But it was done a while ago. And Sam was there. And the Resonance's former manager, Sarah Nicol, introduced us. And,
okay.
And I remember Chris Weaver of Ossetor Binnage was there.
Sure.
And he said, who was that? He seemed cool. And I said, I don't know. I thought he was your friend. And he said, no, you seem to like know each other. It seemed like there was I thought you knew him really well. I thought you were going to introduce him to me.
Yeah.
I said, no, I only just met him that day.
Okay.
So it was interesting.
Right. So the latest cassette release is called Sculpture Garden.
The Sculpture Garden, yeah.
Why is it called The Sculpture Garden?
Oh, I actually did think about that, and I feel like the Sculpture Garden is an apt name. One, because I saw a poster that MoMA had produced of their Sculpture Garden, and thought it was excellent and wanted to utilise it as cover art. But also because in my mind, each song kind of is representative of a particular like emotion or sense of feelings or moment in time, and they're all kind of like little sculptures.
Right.
Kind of in my own kind of mental sculpture garden. So, in effect,
so you're visualizing the album as a series of sculptures.
You're walking around the sculpture garden within my mind. Yeah, effectively, it's very egotistical.
That's all right. Should we play this Reverence track, which you were talking about earlier? If we play that now, and then we might be able to talk about that. What's to say? Could you introduce this one?
So this is Reverence is Dead, and then in brackets, Good Riddance.
Good luck. everybody out there. One.
Okay, well, you're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM with sound artists Samuel Robinson and Dan Wilson. And we're sort of talking around cassette culture because that's from the Sculpture Garden by your, what do I call it, your stage name or something?
Alias.
Or, Alias Kalu, which was... is released on cassette. And are all of your things released initially on cassette?
A couple of them. I made cassettes for work that I had made in the last two decades ago now.
When you're making them, do you visualize them ending up on cassette as an eventual
product? I think I visualize them as no, I don't.
Okay.
So they're a curious mixing between digital format and tape format in a way, because they're downloadable and they're tape and they're not made with any cassette. I thought you had a kind of cassette impetus. Like as you were making them, you were kind of almost designing these tunes to be cassette based eventually.
I think one thing that's different about this album to that I didn't do on previous stuff is I had on this one a solid set of songs that I knew I wanted to be a body of work, whereas like other stuff I've done has just been kind of, well, I've made this load of songs and then kind of I'll sequence them in a way that kind of makes a slightly cohesive album. But this is probably, you know, I've been making music for 20 years. It's probably this is the most kind of solid set, I think, of a
Were you talking about that particular track? Can you run us through the idea?
As I kind of mentioned before, it's kind of just, I mean, actually, if we're honest, it's a piece of music I composed and I fixed this title to it. In fact, I had a title in mind, I think, even before I had produced the song. But it's gone, Dan.
Well, it's a very descriptive piece, isn't it? This Reverence is Dead and... In the sections, it's almost like a Victorian piece of program music. There's all these grandiose movements in it, and there's a theme where reverence dies. There's the flying.
I think of it as like that. There's this wild kind of guitar sounding riff going through the verse, and these kind of out of control horns, and that's kind of the ego of reverence, like owning an overlord and kind of deciding what's right and what's good taste and who can do what and kind of demanding things of subordinates. But then reverence kind of like hits the 21st century I think when did we make this 2018 when people have decided no, that's not good enough, and I'm gonna, you know, certain people have outed people that's influenced this title
and eclipsed,
and then there's a kind of car crash. What sounds like, in my mind, I envision it as a car crash in the middle, and that's the death of reverence. And I think of it as like there's ashes, and out of those ashes come an honor system built on merit, and that's kind of what arises from the car crash. And then
this sounds like a sort of quite revolutionary, isn't it? This is a manifesto for something.
Really like to think of this as like people one day, like in terms of that sense of like. Wanting one day to be discovered or people to enjoy your music. I forget all of that. I just want this song to be the voice of the sound of like a revolution. People with like fists pumping.
We'll keep the stems so someone can remix it in the future. They'll be looking to do different versions of this at some point.
Yes.
And there is a siren and a crash in the distance.
A thump, a distant whomp. Okay. So we're going to search for another track now. This will be quite interesting because we're actually doing this live on air. We're rattling through the cassette.
You're hearing
to try and find the next track.
And it'll be.
And how are you going to find the beginning of it? You just kind of.
Oh, monitoring with.
You keep stopping and starting.
It's
this is one of the drawbacks.
The
joys of cassette. Yeah.
But this is going to be the remix that Dan did of the fourth track, which is called Floundering. And it's an old song. I originally made this song in 2008. It's kind of an ode to uncertainty and not knowing what you feel for someone or whether you feel something for them because they kind of offer something to you. And it's kind of dealing with that doubt of relationships and love and how we can't control time or change the past as much as we want to. I gave the stems to Dan and asked humbly if he would work on it and and make something new and fresh, because for me, I'd kind of sat with this song for 11 years or so.
Wow. Okay. What's it called, this one?
Floundering.
Floundering. Okay. And there's two versions of this on the album, then. This is what this is your own remixing of it.
Some of the chord sequences in it, and I thought it had a lot. It's got popular appeal, and I thought I could make it more popular by adding all kinds of.
Will you split the royalties then?
If there are royalties, no, Reverence is dead. There are no royalties.
Okay, all right.
You can hear the mechanics of the tape.
You wanted to, at some point, you said something about Baxterisms. Does that come into this? How does that play into this?
While Sam is trying to find the track, I've got his press release here, so I'm going back. But this Ed's not mentioned here. Ed Baxter is the Resonance controller,
director.
Yeah,
yeah.
And oddly, his bass features on this Sam's release. Ed Baxter's bass guitar.
Does he play the bass guitar?
That's what I thought, but it's not.
I don't know.
He just owns it.
I thought he sampled him playing the bass, but that would be
amazing. I'd love that.
That would be a weird bit of social circuit bending in song form.
But what is the case? It's just his guitar.
We don't know. He might play the bass.
He does it in the Resonance Radio Orchestra.
He certainly wasn't using that bass to play the bass when he did, because that bass sat in his office for a year that I worked here. So when I wanted to start recording the songs, I borrowed
Resonance Radio Orchestra events where Ed does play the bass, and I think it's a perfect instrument for him because it's quite,
How does that relate to this track then?
I think Ed's bass is in it.
No, this actually is bass. So a lot of the core, sorry to pour water over this theory, a lot of the core music in this one, actually, unlike the rest of the songs, was composed a while ago.
Okay. So this, pre-Ed then?
No, I knew Ed.
Okay.
Actually, this is when I was at LCC. Ed was
under John Wynn.
Under John Wynn. Ed was one of my tutors and was telling me about Resonance. So.
And this is where the name Reverence is Dead came from.
Ed is not the figure that needs to be destroyed.
No.
Ed is incredibly supportive.
That's very much a Baxterism, though. The Reverence is Dead. The philosophy of not adhering to prescriptive ideals.
Is it just being contrary?
I don't know. I can't speak for Ed. Not in the sense of Reverence is Dead. It's not about kind of just going against the grain for the sake of it.
Yeah, there's something deeper with that one.
No. Okay. So, all right. How long is this track roughly? Do we know?
3-4 minutes.
Okay, so we still have a few minutes at the end. Okay. So this is Floundering, yeah?
Meadowhouse mix.
So that's the Floundering remix.
That's Floundering, the Meadow House remix, which is a bit more crowded than the original. Is also on the tape as well.
And this is Sam singing.
Sam, yeah, it's Sam's track. It's been, the chord sequences have been changed, and I've tried to capture the essence of what it is to be Floundering in the breakdown, which is a bubbly synth-led kind of.
I think it's a really great addition to the album because the original song is a bit, not morose, but like it's a bit wistful and
I loved it. I thought it was very 1990s, and I tried to accentuate that aspect of it.
I think you did a really good job in the sense that it reminds me of what a remix on a kind of 90, like a remix of something, like something I wouldn't appreciate at the time, but now I appreciate kind of remix work more. I have a Chumbawamba tape, and I was looking at it from 97, and like listening to the remix, and I appreciate them more. Than I did back then.
All right. Well, thank you to the sound artists, Sam Robinson and Dan Wilson. Sam, your album is The Sculpture Garden, under your alias.
Yes.
Where can we get
Kalu.
The sculpture?
Kalu.
You can download The Sculpture Garden from Bandcamp. So that's Kalu, kalou.bandcamp.com or kalu.co.uk. And I had something.
If
else
anyone
I was
really
say.
Wanted to get the cassette,
if they really want to get the cassette, then they should get in contact with me through Bandcamp or through my website, kalou.co.uk,
or go to a laundry shop,
or go to a local laundromat, and I probably will drop one there.
All right. Okay. Well, thank you very much to both of you for coming in, and this is Resonance 104.4 FM. When it comes to lyrics, crinkles up like hazel from Girls Down the Morning.
This program has been brought to you by Resonance FM. If you like what you heard, please support our work by making a donation at resonancefm.com/donate.